والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah. وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Stories. Tunisia and Pakistan say they do not intend to establish diplomatic relations with Israel. Iran once again rejects any proposal for the revision and renegotiation of the 2015 nuclear deal. Also ahead, U.S. President Trump threatens to veto a much-awaited coronavirus relief bill that includes desperately needed money for individual Americans. Welcome to the program. Tunisia says it is not interested in establishing diplomatic relations with Israel following reports that it may do so. The Tunisian Foreign Ministry said the country's position will not be affected by international developments. The remarks follow reports by U.S. media saying Tunisia might be the next Arab nation to normalize ties with Tel Aviv. Morocco was the latest Arab state to sign U.S. brokered deals with Israel after the UAE, Bahrain, and Sudan did so. On Tuesday, an Israeli envoy arrived in Rabat to meet the Moroccan king on a first direct flight between Israel and Morocco. Palestinians have strongly slammed normalization deals with Israel as a stab in their back and a betrayal of their cause. Palestinians say anti-Israeli sentiments inside the country and similarities between Palestinian and Kashmir disputes provide sufficient grounds to reject the UAE efforts to normalize Islamabad's ties with Tel Aviv. Pakistan's stance, or clear stance, on this issue has come after its foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi. Javed Rana has more.
Pakistan had a fresh round of negotiations with the UAE in an effort to repair lingering strained relations between the two countries. Pakistan has been under pressure from the UAE to normalize ties with the apartheid state of Israel since August this year, when Abu Dhabi recognized Tel Aviv. For the first time, Islamabad publicly admitted about the existence of a lingering UAE demand to Pakistan to grant diplomatic recognition to Israel, something which Islamabad rejected after the country's foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi.
I have abundantly made it clear to the UAE that Pakistan under no circumstances can establish diplomatic ties with Israel until a permanent and durable solution is found to the Palestinian issue. I have told them about anti-Israeli public sentiments in Pakistan and reminded them of the similar nature of dispute between Kashmir and Palestine.
Foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi has followed suspension of visas to Pakistani citizens after alleged behind-the-scenes threats to Islamabad to replace its 1.5 million expatriates if Pakistan resisted pressure to normalize ties with Tel Aviv.
Pakistan made its position clear because of the mounting pressure from some of the Islamic countries. The problem for Pakistan is that at the public level, at the people level, it is very difficult to sell this idea of giving recognition to Israel, because for decades, Pakistani people have been steadfastly supporting the cause of the Palestinian people.
Despite close brother relations with the UAE, tens of thousands of people protested against Abu Dhabi after it normalized ties with Tel Aviv. Israel has been desperate to normalize ties with Pakistan, hoping that if it happens, other Islamic countries would also follow the suit. However, observers say that Israel's effort through UAE and Saudi Arabia to create compelling conditions against Pakistan to normalize ties have fallen flat. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The UN General Assembly has adopted a resolution urging Israel to halt demolition and confiscating Palestinian homes in the occupied territories. Resolution, among other things, urged Israel to cease destroying civilian and vital infrastructure in the occupied territories. The General Assembly adopted the measure following a report by one of its committees on the situation in those territories. Rights groups say a large number of Palestinians have been displaced this year as a result of continued Israeli demolitions. The regime says it destroys the structures that lack construction permits. Palestinians reject this. They say the demolitions are aimed at expanding Israeli settlements that are illegal under international law. Iran has reaffirmed its opposition to any offer of renegotiation or revision of the 2015 nuclear deal. This is while the European signatories to the deal are hoping for the possible return of the U.S. to the agreement after President-elect Joe Biden takes office next month.
The United Nations Security Council has held a virtual meeting to review the 10th report into the implementation of Resolution 2231, which endorses the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. During the session on Tuesday, Iran's permanent representative to the UN slammed the United States for not only failing to honor its own obligations under the resolution, but also obstructing the implementation of the commitments by other signatories. Takra Banshi explained that in the past 4 years, the U.S. has imposed over 1,500 sanctions against Iran, targeting almost all sectors of Tehran's economy and cutting nearly all dividends from the nuclear agreement for Iran. He also referred to the humanitarian impacts of the sanctions on Iran, saying the embargoes are affecting the most vulnerable people in the country.
The United States claim that humanitarian goods are exempt from sanctions is an absolute lie. As an example, even today, we cannot easily import medicine for relieving the breathing problems of those injured by chemical weapons, which were provided by some Western countries to Saddam and used by him during his aggression against Iran.
The Iranian ambassador reiterated Tehran's stance that any proposal for the revision, renegotiation, or extension of the JCPOA is against the UN Resolution 2231 and absolutely unacceptable.
Iran has paid a heavy price and has done much more than its fair share to preserve the JCPOA. Therefore, no one can expect us to do more.
Takra Banshi further said that the deal cannot be linked to anything outside of the nuclear program, such as Iran's missile capabilities.
To develop a conventional missile program is an inherent right of any country under international law, and Iran is no exception. Consequently, Iran will not negotiate its legitimate ballistic missile program.
The Security Council session came a day after foreign ministers of the remaining signatories to the JCPOA held a virtual meeting and reiterated their commitments to preserving the agreement. China and Russia in particular call on the U.S. to unconditionally return to the deal and lift its unilateral sanctions against Iran. This comes more than 3 weeks after the Iranian parliament passed a bill that requires the Iranian government to suspend more commitments under the nuclear deal in case sanctions continue. Iran started scaling back some of its commitments a year after the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal. Tehran has time and again rejected any preconditions for reviving the agreement, noting that they will go back to full compliance once all the other parties to the court uphold their own end of the deal.
A bomb attack has targeted a police car on the outskirts of Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. Local media say a policeman was killed and two others got injured after their car was hit by a roadside bomb. No further details are available now. There's been no claim of responsibility either. Violence has surged in Afghanistan in the past few months, that is, especially in the capital, Kabul. A tally shows more than 130 people have been killed in the city over the past 2 months. The surge comes as the government is in talks with Taliban militants for a peace deal. Now, U.S. President Trump has rejected a $900 billion bipartisan COVID stimulus package. He says it does not address concerns caused by the pandemic.
It really is a disgrace. For example, among the more than 5,000 pages in this bill, which nobody in Congress has read because of its length and complexity, it's called the COVID relief bill, but it has almost nothing to do with COVID. It really is.
While Trump did not explicitly say he would not sign the bill, he made clear that he would not accept the legislation. He asked Congress to eliminate what he called unnecessary items from the legislation and send in a suitable one. The president demanded lawmakers more than triple relief payments to Americans. The bill was passed overwhelmingly by both chambers of Congress on Monday after months of political wrangling. The package includes jobless programs and supports U.S. businesses battered by the pandemic. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden has criticized incumbent Donald Trump for downplaying the seriousness of a recent large-scale cyber attack on the American government.
This attack constitutes a grave risk to our national security. It was carefully planned and carefully orchestrated. It is a grave risk, and it continues. I see no evidence that it's under control. I've seen none. Heard of none. The Defense Department won't even brief us. I know of nothing that suggests it's under control. This president hasn't even identified who's responsible yet.
Biden accused Trump of failing or falling down on his job to protect the U.S., saying the attack cannot go unanswered. Last week, the U.S. Cybersecurity Agency said hackers had accessed computer systems of dozens of organizations and federal agencies. Officials said several departments and dozens of companies were affected. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and other officials have blamed the hack on Russia, but President Trump has pointed the finger at China. He has blamed media for making what he calls Russia hype. Beijing and Moscow have denied any involvement. Well, the number of daily coronavirus fatalities in Germany is on the rise, with authorities fearing that the number of deaths could reach the grim milestone of 1,000 again. German officials said the daily number of deaths rose by 962, bringing the total tally to nearly 28,000. Germany had recorded 1,000 deaths on December the 11th. That was the highest ever since the pandemic started. German authorities also said nearly 25,000 new infections were reported. That takes the total number of cases to more than 1.5 million. Germany has been under partial lockdown since early November, shutting bars, restaurants, and entertainment venues. Now, related development to COVID-19, France has eased a temporary UK travel ban introduced after a new variant of coronavirus was identified in Britain. The French Prime Minister's office says EU nationals and residents are allowed to enter France from the UK, providing they show negative COVID-19 tests no more than 72 hours old. In its statement, the office added that the test must be of a type capable of detecting this new variant. So far, more than 40 countries across the world have blocked flights to, blocked flights or travel links with the UK. The World Health Organization has, however, said the new strain is a normal part of the evolution of the pandemic.
All flights and trains coming from the United Kingdom have been barred from entering Europe. Other countries, including Canada, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Colombia, and Morocco, have also suspended flights to and from the UK for 48 hours or more. Britons have been rattled by the Prime Minister's announcement that Christmas visits will have to be cancelled because of the new COVID-19 strain. And now there are growing fears the country will run out of fresh food in the days before Christmas because of freight and transport disruption. The government insists there's nothing to be worried about, though, and that ahead of Brexit, the government is fully prepared.
It's vital first to stress that these delays, which are only occurring at Dover, only affect human-handled freight, and that is only 20% of the total arriving from or departing to the European continent, which means the vast majority of food, medicines and other supplies are coming and going as normal.
The British government is dealing with an escalating public health crisis, deepening economic upheaval and Brexit trade talks in Brussels simultaneously. Prime Minister Boris Johnson's handling of all three crises has come under fire and faith in the government is waning.
It's just got to a point where now people are just going to feel like their freedom is being restricted and their basic sort of human rights, and it's spending millions of pounds on an app that doesn't even work. So, I mean, yeah, making promises they can't adhere to. So I think, yeah, they've really shot themselves in the foot.
They're doing an okay job. I think obviously they could probably do better. But, you know, I think it's always easy when you're looking on the outside in, going, you know, we'd do this or that.
No more promises that we'll be over this by such and such a date, a day at a time now. I mean, it's a difficult situation for the government, but no more promises we'll be over this by Christmas, Easter, a day at a time. It's debatable. Who would want to be in the government situation at the moment? It's changing by the day worldwide.
I think, you know, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. I would... As people to think about, you know, what would they have done if they'd have been faced with everything that has happened, because I don't necessarily think that there's one right course of action. I don't necessarily think that our government have handled it the perfect way, but what is the perfect way kind of thing? And I don't think people have helped themselves by rebelling against the rules and all of that kind of thing. So
people are going to complain no matter what Boris Johnson says or does. So
the new strain of COVID-19 has already been detected in the Netherlands, Denmark, Belgium and Iceland. On the upside, the scientists are saying the new strain is not resistant to the vaccines now being approved and administered. More than 500,000 people have received the Pfizer jab in the UK, which was the first country to approve it, and Europe's medicine regulators have approved it as well, which means inoculations will be underway across the bloc in a matter of days. Bianca Rahimi, London.
An alliance of local parties has emerged victorious in Indian-controlled Kashmir elections. Elections come after India stripped Kashmir's semi-autonomous status last year. Our correspondent Shahanabad reports.
Amid stringent security measures, counting of votes took place in Kashmir. The alliance of local parties emerged victorious by winning a maximum number of seats in the local administration. The elections in Kashmir come at a time when all the political processes in the region were halted after New Delhi stripped Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in August 2019. India's unilateral decision has not been accepted by the local pro-India political parties in Kashmir, and they aim to fight the decision. Victorious candidates and supporters perceive this win as a victory of people's verdict against what they call BJP's propagandist narrative on Kashmir.
We want our democracy to work in a real sense. No one should take decisions on behalf of our people. We participated in these elections to know what policies are implemented in the region. More important is our identity, and we will fight for it legally.
Political analyst Gohar Gilani says the results have clearly showed that the people of Kashmir stand by the People's Alliance.
The PAGD wins. They will see it as a referendum for the position that they have taken, which is against the, you know, decisions taken on August 5 last year.
But at the same time, Gohar Gilani is critical of these local pro-India political parties, considering their track records.
You know, why PAGD participated in the elections? They say that they are there because they do not want to further, you know, give away the political space, whatever little is left there. But at the same time, the counter argument is when there was political space in their hands, still the New Delhi, still New Delhi did what they wanted to do. They dismissed the chief minister. They removed Sheikh Abdullah as prime minister in 1953 and did what they wanted. They did what they wanted to do in 1960s. So this entire argument is, you know, flawed in many ways. But at the same time, it has somehow broken the ice in a way that there is no stalemate.
After total 280 seats, the People's Alliance is leading, followed by BJP, Indian National Congress, and others.
The local election results in Indian administered Kashmir are seen by many as the new political chapter that would determine the future political discourse of this Muslim majority region. Analysts say, considering the political history of Kashmir, a deep-rooted mistrust in New Delhi and local pro-India political parties persists, and people here only seem to be choosing the lesser evil. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
In the limelight.
A recent report by the rights group stated that all Moderna's COVID-19 vaccines and 96% of Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine doses have been secured by rich countries, including Canada, the United Kingdom, and the United States. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine is currently being administered in Canada, while Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said Moderna's vaccine would be used in more remote locations in the country once it secures the necessary regulatory approvals. Stephen Coburn, head of Economic and Social Justice at Amnesty International, said Canada is a country that's ordered the most vaccines per person in the world, adding, if all the vaccines that they've ordered are proven to be safe and effective, it would mean enough vaccines to immunize the population five times over. Coburn said, with pharmaceutical companies having a finite capacity to produce vaccines, richer countries earmarking so many in advance can create a global shortage of supply. We prepared for you an article written by Yasmin Hassan under the heading, Is Canada's Me First COVID Vaccine Policy Hurting Other Nations? The article has been taken from the AlJazeera.com website. Please stay with us for more of Yasmin Hassan's article. Frontline healthcare workers and residents of long-term care homes received the first COVID-19 vaccines in Canada recently, marking what officials said is the beginning of the end of the pandemic that brought the world to a halt. But as people in some parts of the world breathe a sigh of relief, others will not be able to join in the collective jubilation for months, if not years, to come. Stephen Coburn, head of Economic and Social Justice at Amnesty International, said that is because countries including Canada have hoarded the majority of the vaccines. A recent report by the rights group stated that all of Moderna's COVID-19 vaccines and 96% of Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine doses have been secured by rich countries, including Canada, the United Kingdom, and the United States. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine is currently being administered in Canada, while Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said Moderna's vaccine would be used in more remote locations in the country once it secures the necessary regulatory approvals. Coburn told Al Jazeera, Canada is a country that's ordered the most vaccines per person in the world. If all the vaccines that they've ordered are proven to be safe and effective, it will mean enough vaccines to immunize the entire population of Canada five times over. Coburn said, with pharmaceutical companies having a finite capacity to produce vaccines, which a country is earmarking so many in advance, can create a global shortage of supply. Extension that could complicate international efforts to ensure the equal distribution of vaccine shots, such as COVAX, a global initiative launched by the World Health Organization, WHO, in April of this year, to ensure safe and effective COVID-19 vaccines are distributed evenly between nations. Stephen Coburn said, "Many countries have seen the vaccine, understandably so, as their way out of this crisis, and it's been a race." Adding, rather than work together, we've had a me-first attitude in many countries, and there's been a lack of multilateralism and global coordination in the world. An equitable vaccine and drug distribution has been an issue for many years. Dr. Katarina Perahodov, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Amsterdam and fellow at the World Health Organization Collaborating Center in Health Promotion at the University of Toronto in Canada, said that is because drug development is driven by the market. She told Al Jazeera, in the last 2 decades, we've seen a decline in the number of vaccine developers and producers globally, and that further concentrates and privatizes vaccine development and manufacturing capacity around the world. The system sets up richer countries to receive the first vaccines faster because they have the money to stand at the front of the line and buy vaccines from the private companies that created them. In other words, a profit-driven model of drug development will see scarce supplies go to the highest bidder, even though pandemic recovery hinges on international cooperation and the equitable global distribution of vaccines. However, Dr. Katarina Perahodov said that in the current circumstances, it is understandable that countries will be trying to get themselves out of the crisis first. She said, securing a big piece of the world's limited vaccine supply inevitably leaves less room for others. And that decision also has important human rights and ethical implications for countries like Canada to assist lower-resourced nations to access these medicines. Justin Trudeau recently told reporters Canada, home to just 38 million people, expects to receive 168 million doses of the Moderna vaccine and as many as 249 million Pfizer-BioNTech doses before the end of the year. The country has reported more than 481,000 cases of COVID-19 since the pandemic began and over 13,000 deaths linked to the novel coronavirus. Karina Gould, Canada's Minister of International Development, claimed Canada has been among the donors to international initiatives such as COVAX, a World Health Organization-led effort that brings together world leaders, philanthropists, and others to accelerate the development of COVID-19 tests, treatments, and vaccines. Karina Gould said, "The idea is that if you're a self-financing country or a low-income country, that within the first year that the vaccine is available, you will receive enough doses for 20% of your population." But Stephen Coburn at Amnesty International insisted that leaders need to see the battle against COVID-19 as a collective one. He said, "I understand that governments are under pressure by their populations, as well as to make sure that they get vaccines. We would argue that That is unfair and also short-sighted. If you only vaccinate a portion of the world, you still can't really open up global trade or global travel, and you risk the virus coming back into your own country.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Saeed Pereza. Our top story: the United Kingdom is grappling with a new variant of the COVID-19 virus and the international response to it. Dozens of countries have suspended all arrivals from Britain, even as officials warned the new travel bans could wreak havoc on the supply chains of food and goods days before Christmas. Meanwhile, people across the country are trying to come to terms with their plans having been canceled at the last minute. Bianca Rahimi has our report.
All flights and trains coming from the United Kingdom have been barred from entering Europe. Other countries, including Canada, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Colombia, and Morocco, have also suspended flights to and from the UK for 48 hours or more. Britons have been rattled by the Prime Minister's announcement that Christmas visits will have to be cancelled because of the new COVID-19 strain. And now there are growing fears the country will run out of fresh food in the days before Christmas because of freight and transport disruption. The government insists there's nothing to be worried about, though, and that ahead of Brexit, the government is fully prepared.
It's vital first to stress that these delays, which are only occurring at Dover, only affect human-handled freight, and that is only 20% of the total arriving from or departing to the European continent, which means the vast majority of food, medicines and other supplies are coming and going as normal.
The British government is dealing with an escalating public health crisis, deepening economic upheaval and Brexit trade talks in Brussels simultaneously. Prime Minister Boris Johnson's handling of all three crises has come under fire and faith in the government is waning.
It's just got to a point where now people are just going to feel like their freedom is being restricted and their basic sort of human rights, and it's spending millions of pounds on an app that doesn't even work. So, I mean, yeah, making promises they can't adhere to. So I think, yeah, they've really shot themselves in the foot.
They're doing an okay job. I think obviously they could probably do better. But, you know, I think it's always easy when you're looking on the outside in, going, you know, we'd do this or that.
No more promises that we'll be over this by such and such a date at a time now. I mean, it's a difficult situation for the government. But no more promises. We'll be over this by Christmas, Easter, a day at a time. It's debatable. And who would want to be in the government situation at the moment? It's changing by the day worldwide.
I think, you know, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. I would urge people to think about, you know, what would they have done if they'd have been faced with everything that has happened, because I don't necessarily think that there's one right course of action. I don't necessarily think that our government have handled it the perfect way, but what is the perfect way kind of thing? And I don't think people have helped themselves by rebelling against the rules and all of that kind of thing. So
people are going to complain no matter what Boris Johnson says or does. So
the new strain of COVID-19 has already been detected in the Netherlands, Denmark, Belgium and Iceland. On the upside, the scientists are saying the new strain is not resistant to the vaccines now being approved and administered. More than 500,000 people have received the Pfizer jab in the UK, which was the first country to approve it, and Europe's medicine regulators have approved it as well, which means inoculations will be underway across the bloc in a matter of days. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Meanwhile, the World Health Organization has called for more details of the potential impact of the new coronavirus strain in the UK, which has led more than 40 countries to close their borders to Britain.
We've seen many variants emerge over the last number of months, and some have been successful, some have not been as successful as establishing themselves as part of the driving force of COVID. What no variant has done yet is establish itself as having any higher level of severity or evading our diagnostics or hiding from vaccines.
However, the chief executive at BioNTech, Ugur Sahin, has warned their vaccine may not be enough for the new strain.
We have now a new variant, the variant which was discovered in UK. And this variant is a little bit different. It has 9 mutations, not only a single mutation. And we don't know at the moment if our vaccine is also able to provide protection against this new variant.
More tests are underway to understand the new mutation. The heightened lockdown restrictions are expected to be in place until the new year. Let's unpack all of that with Ranjit Barar. He's an NHS consultant, a physician and surgeon, joining me now. It's good to have you with us, as always. So let's talk about the virus and then the cure. There have been, 17 mutations of the virus so far, according to one source. Why has this one caused so much alarm, and how concerned are you by it?
So good to be with you. In fact, there have been some 4,000 different mutations so far characterized. This is a relatively simple virus. There are only 17 genes within it, but each gene has a complex genetic code. If you imagine that the virus gets inside a patient, uses our own, it's not a fully fledged organism, it uses our own cellular apparatus to reproduce itself, and it does so billions of times every time that enters a single individual, and of course tens of millions of individuals, you know, human beings have caught this virus so far. So the ability for missense replication, so forth, for mutations of the virus are large. And actually, there have been, amongst all the different centers who are performing these extensive genotypes, of course, it was the Chinese first who realized this was a new disease, who published its genotype and shared it with the world. But then that's been replicated throughout many centers in many advanced countries throughout the world. And we've identified some 4,000 different types.
How concerned are you by it, Doctor?
Not hugely, to be honest. A large amount of play has been made by our own government about this particular strain being the reason for their new variation again in the lockdown. But really, to me, that was a matter of the ongoing failure of public health measures, the ongoing failure of our government to get to grips with the virus.
We'll get to the failures of the government soon, but let's talk about the cure too, this vaccine, question marks on its effectiveness. We heard the CEO of BioNTech, Ugur Sahin, saying in one breath that he was confident it was going to work against the virus, and then in another he said it was probably not enough.
There's an extent to which all of this is speculation. It's sufficiently new, this vaccine, though probably this virus, the mutation, though it's probably been known since September, but we don't know the absolute answers to the questions. It's very likely the vaccines will work against this strain. It's not hugely different. It's got 17 distinct point-based mutations, which don't radically change its structure or function, and still, as far as we can see, there's no difference in the virulence. We know that there's an increasing number of this variation, which are spreading throughout London, Kent, the south of England, and it's becoming even the dominant form of the COVID virus. But we've seen that before with the G614 mutation, which essentially has, at this point, become the pandemic. So
that
point
sure is reassuring, Ranjit. But let me go back to your point earlier about the government. What they have done is, well, they have been late twice to lock the country down or areas with high infection rates. At one point, do you think the media and this establishment will be held to account?
Well, I think we've seen the extent to which the media and the establishment are joined at the hip, that they really are functioning as a concerted whole. I thought your report was very balanced, but if you look at the reaction from the public, you know, really devoid of serious criticism, thinking that there's no perfect way to handle this, it shows the extent to which our public opinion is manipulated. They need only look as far as China. They need only look as far as Taiwan, really, to see that there is a way of actually eradicating the virus, and that was through public health measures that put the interests of the population first, not the interests of big business first. We've seen huge amounts of money go to the private sector, to cronies of the Tory government. We've seen actually very little targeted and effective action designed to support working people, isolate them, effectively support them when they have the virus, keep them separate from the general population, and in that way, limited spread. And it's that that's leading to the new lockdown, not really the emergence, in my mind, of a new strain.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Ranjit Brar, an NHS consultant, physician, and surgeon. Appreciate your time. Well, we're going to stay with the virus. Two Vatican cardinals who work closely with the Pope, Pope Francis, have tested positive for COVID-19. Polish Cardinal Konrad Karajewski, 57 years old, responsible for managing the Pontiff's charities, was hospitalized after contracting pneumonia through severe COVID-19. Italian Cardinal Giuseppe Bertallo, 78, the governor of Vatican City, is believed to be self-isolating in his own home. Italy, the first Western country hit by the virus, has seen nearly 70,000 COVID-19 fatalities since February, the highest toll in Europe. It has also registered some 1,097,000 cases to date. Two other news. A German court has jailed a far-right gunman for life for a deadly attack on a synagogue in the eastern city of Halle last year. Stefan Baliet, 28, shot and killed a female passerby and a man at a store after failing to break into the synagogue. Prosecutors said the terrorist aimed to kill as many as possible of the more than 50 worshippers inside. During the five-month trial, Baliet said the attack was not a mistake and that those inside the synagogue were his enemies.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Russia has imposed a series of new sanctions on EU officials in retaliation for the punitive measures by the EU on Moscow over Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny. The Russian Foreign Ministry summoned German, French, and Swedish representatives in response to the EU's move just last month. 44-year-old Alexei Navalny was hospitalized after falling ill, you remember, on a domestic flight in Russia in August. His close aides and Western governments have claimed the Kremlin tried to kill him with poison. Moscow has denied all allegations of involvement. All right, all good to go now. In this segment, the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has claimed those eight Katyusha rockets that hit the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad Sunday came from, quote, Iran-backed militias. Let's see how that went down in Iran and on social media. Robert Carter is the man with that story. Robert, over to you.
Thanks, Saeed. So, yes, you've summed up the story very, very well. Obviously, this is just one of the many cases in which the U.S. has essentially blamed Iran for everything that's happening in the region against them. But, of course, they don't contextualize the fact that the U.S. is deeply despised by many factions within Iraq. So the fact that they've decided to blame Iran so quickly and without a proper investigation or any evidence to prove that Iran was at all involved in the incident is just typical of the Trump regime. Obviously, Iran has responded to this very aggressively. They've made very, very clear that they have no role in the incident, which you can see on screen now. That's, of course, the U.S. Green Zone in Baghdad, where the embassy is located, and they, of course, are trying to defend themselves from the projectiles. But let's play a snippet of a response from the Iranian Foreign Office spokesperson, who not only responded to the accusation, but sent his own warnings to the U.S. as well.
I completely and strongly condemn remarks by America's Secretary of State. I think that the Iraqi government will definitely find the perpetrators and those who ordered the attacks based on its duties. I also warn the United States regime not to seek starting a fire and waging conflict in these days.
And like you said, Robert, they have scapegoated Iran all these 4 years. How has social media reacted to this?
Well, I can bring you the reaction that's caused the upset. It's the tweet itself from the U.S. Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, and he says in the tweet that he blames Iran-backed militias once again for flagrantly and recklessly attacking U.S. Positions in Baghdad, wounding Iraqi civilians and so on. Now, obviously, let's bring the Iranian reaction. Again, tweeting this on social media is the Foreign Office spokesperson, who says, "We strongly refute the irresponsible anti-Iran accusations, which blatantly aim to create tensions. Iran rejects any attack on diplomatic missions." That's a key point. The U.S. military presence is the source of instability in the region. No amount of spin and divert blame for its evils. A very valid point mentioned there. The third tweet I've brought up is actually an earlier tweet from the Iranian Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, again addressing Mike Pompeo during one of his many anti-Iran tweets. He said earlier on that, Mike Pompeo, your own restrictions actually sanctioned U.S. companies out of Iran's markets with its unparalleled natural and human resources, and your illicit maximum failure policy cancelled Boeing's contracts for 88 million. So ultimately, the point here is that whatever Mike Pompeo's statement or position is on Iran, it's proven to have failed time and time again. So ultimately, going forward, these accusations, baseless accusations, are not going to win out or make any difference.
Maximum failure policy, that's quotable. Story two now. While some countries turn their backs on Palestinians and normalize ties with Israel, others are holding their ground, in this case, Pakistan.
Absolutely. So it's become apparent that the United Arab Emirates, which has already decided to throw its support and rub shoulders with the Israeli regime, totally backstabbing the Palestinian cause, has been reaching out to the Muslim-majority country of Pakistan to try and encourage them to do the same. Pakistan has reiterated its position, saying that there is absolutely no chance that they will even consider normalizing ties with the Israeli regime until the Palestinian cause is settled one way or another. So ultimately, this is a reiteration of an earlier policy which was made clear weeks ago by Pakistan. But clearly, and this is the point, the pressure is still on. It's being applied by the U.S. and its regional proxies to keep trying to convince Muslim countries to normalize ties, which is, of course, against what the wishes of the majority of Muslims in the Muslim world want. The majority of Muslims maintain pro-Palestinian positions, Saeed.
Right. I have drawn a blank, to be honest. I don't know if you have a soundbite or anything. If not, please bring us the online reaction to Pakistan's position.
Yes, so of course, there has been a heated online reaction, as you can imagine, some interesting points raised. So let's bring up the first tweet. see what was said. It's from Khan here, who says that it's nice, it's a good positive stance from Pakistan after such a shameful UAE-led narrative. So many Arab countries are betraying Palestine, so a bit of praise there for some non-Arab Muslim powers which are maintaining their pro-Palestine positions. Let's go to the next tweet and see what was said again. Another valid point, I believe, that was raised on social media. This is from Michael this time, who says it's worth noting that post-Abraham Accords, Pakistani officials keep insisting again and again that Pakistan won't recognize Israel anytime soon, but none of their statements have ruled out engagements with Israel that fall short of recognition. So again, perhaps there are other avenues in which Pakistan will explore, but we have yet to see any evidence of that, Saeed. Let's go to the third and final tweet on this subject, which I can bring you now. It's actually highlighting a very interesting point, I think. It's saying that Pakistan has taken tough stances this year against Israel, the US, India, and indeed has a rift with Saudi Arabia going on as well. They are in need of friends, and this Twitter user seems to believe that they will turn more towards China, Turkey, and possibly Iran going forward. So let's wait and see how this regional dispute pans out.
Let's wait and see, as you say, Robert Carter, with those stories, Robert. And that story segues nicely into this other one. Two more stories we're going to bring you in this segment as well from what's been trending on social media. Days after the U.S. formally removed Sudan from its list of state sponsors of terrorism, the country's Congress has passed a bill restoring Khartoum's sovereignty immunity. Well, let's discuss that story with Ahmed Kabbalah, who joins me now to look at the fine print. Ahmed?
Hi, Saeed. Yes. So this was a sticking point in the negotiations. So although on the 14th of December, Saddam was formally lifted from the state sponsor of terror designation, it basically refused to fully accept normalization with Israel unless Congress passed this law which would protect it from future legal action from victims of Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden's terrorism. Now, the US was trying to claim that because Osama bin Laden lived in Sudan from 1991 to 1996, that the crimes of Osama bin Laden thereafter are somehow a responsibility of Sudan. Now, Sudanese people and supporters of Sudan have said, well, before 1991, in 1989, the US was backing Osama bin Laden, supporting him, financing him in the Afghan war against the Soviets. So if Sudan's responsible for the crimes of Osama bin Laden, then so is the US responsible for the crimes of bin Laden. Now, we accepted paying $335 million of compensation, but we did not want to be in endless litigation for crimes that have nothing to do with the Sudanese people.
And Ahmed, the timing of it all is also important. The offer for normalization also came at a time when Sudan is in economic turmoil. Its currency has lost 50% of its value. Bring us what the online opinion has been on this latest development.
Yes, so the first tweet says, you've given Sudan immunity for future lawsuits by the victims of the 1998 American embassy bombings in East Africa and provided Sudan with close to $1 billion in U.S. financial aid and loans. That's not an agreement. That's a short-term bribe. And they're right. The way that they agreed, they pushed Sudan to normalize relations with Israel was a combination of the carrot and the stick. The stick was, if you don't do this, the economy will free fall, there'll be economic ruin, and if you do this, we'll give you financial aid, financial loans, and we'll open up markets.
Another point, Ahmed, can you bring us the other tweet as well, since we're fast running out of time? Thank you.
Yeah, final choice, Sudan to secure win in Congress tonight, partial immunity and millions in assistance and debt relief, turns a page on Omar Bashir's days and clears path for Israeli normalization. And it actually links to our next story because it was passed in a bunch of bills in Congress along with the stimulus package. And many Americans are angry that Sudan has been given $700 million, Israel has been given $500 million, yet American citizens are only given $600 one-off payment in their latest stimulus package. And Nancy Pelosi, who is the Speaker of the House, we've got this VT in which she's announcing this stimulus package.
We also have in the legislation direct payments, which were not in the Republican bill, to America's working families. I would like them been bigger, but they are significant, and they will be going out soon.
What was it in that soundbite that has caused so much outrage on her?
Yes, some people are angry that she said it would be significant. Now, she's worth over $180 million. Her refrigerator is apparently worth $25,000. She eats gourmet ice cream, yet she's saying a one-off payment at $600 is significant. Now, we got a tweet that says, something to think about. Domino's is giving their employees $1,200 bonus, but our government is only giving us $600. How does that work? Now, Domino's is a fast food restaurant chain. They're giving $1,200 bonus to their employees because they've been doing so well. Yet the US government can only afford $600. Final tweet from Alan McLeod says there's only $600 for you in this corona relief bill, but there's $33 million to overthrow the Venezuelan government. Now, within this bill, there's $34 million in democracy promotion in Venezuela, which is basically the language for regime change operations.
Right, someone has been doing the math, Ahmed. First it was Ahmed Caballo with those stories, Ahmed. Thank you. And that's all the time we have for this broadcast.